Hello everybody, my name's Dougie and you're listening to the Made in Scotland 80s podcast. Enjoy! Thank you for coming on the show. You know, thank you very much. John Douglas from the Trash Can Sinatras. I mean, does it get any better than this? No.
All right, yeah. No, it's good to be chatting.
And you know, thank you very much for coming on. And I know the listeners will really appreciate it as well. So if I can pick your brains and take you back to 1986, which is right. 2 years back, how did you all meet? How did the Trash Cans come about?
They started before I was in them. They started off with Frank and Davy Hughes, who became the bass player later on. But in the initial, I mean, I don't know, the initial way they got together, it was back in the days of unemployment.
Yeah.
In Irvine, small town. There was a kind of good sort of musical community there. I was away for a few years. I left Irvine when I was about 18. I came back, I think maybe about 83 or 84. There was quite a good scene going on in Irvine, basically because of, I think it was, if you remember back then, it was quite accepted that there wasn't a lot of prospects for anybody. It was quite a rural place as well. You're away from the big cities. It was the height of the Thatcher decimation of everything. Mm-hmm. Our fathers had went through periods of unemployment, so there wasn't any of the sort of parental pressure to do stuff,
right?
Except keep yourself busy. Uh-huh. And I played guitar, and you sort of gravitate. There was a few pubs where musicians, the weirdos, would sort of gather. You know, it was a kind of funny place. You know, you'd be walking about with a guitar case, and you'd get shouted at. Because it was weird, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was a bit of a risky business. But it was good. There was all kind of post-punk things. There was a band, one of the first bands I saw was called Rebel Dance, or a sort of Clash-type band.
Right.
A band called Dead Souls, it was like a Joy Division-y thing. And there was a local pub, a hotel called The Grange, where they would have regular gigs. Mm-hmm. And there was a place, a youth employment centre, where there was sort of rehearsal space and a bit of gear, a couple of amps, a drum kit. There was a punk band called Warzone. And you would kind of go down there, and there was a couple of guys started a fanzine. So a lot of people my age were quite, you know, they had a lot of time in their hands, but they made use of the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Putting on gigs, quite supportive of each other as far as bands. And as I say, fanzines, just people loving, you know, being creative and the arts and all that sort of stuff. Frank and Davey were on an unemployment scheme. There used to be these 3 month schemes, work experience or something.
Yeah,
and the gig they had, they were in some sort of class, like a disused classroom. And they had to, I don't know how many people were in there, but they had like a month or a few months. And by the end of the month, they had to present some sort of artistic project.
Right.
I think some people might have painted stuff, I don't know. But Frank and Davey decided they would do a show at the end of the thing. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any instruments, but there was a couple of bins. So Davey got some spoons, I think, and started hitting the bins. And I think somebody might have had a guitar. And they sung a few Sinatra songs. They might have changed the words. And they called themselves the Trash Can Sinatras for that day. But that was where the band began, and the kind of the name arrived, and it was just, I think there was various people within the band. It was a covers band for a while.
Right.
And you didn't like Troon or Drossin. And they would be doing things like, I think they would do Elvis tunes and Velvet Underground tunes. When Frank, I met Frank in the pub, I kind of knew of him vaguely. And there was another guy called Paul Ford that played the drums. Uh-huh. And they asked me, would I come and do a gig the next day? It was in the volunteer rooms in Irvine. And I said, yeah, sure, because I was, you know, just enthusiastic to do anything. And I loved them. They were great company. Uh-huh. Everybody was pretty sharp-tongued around about that time. And, you know, Pater was good, and you're just, you know, slagging off everything. And then when you meet people that have the same taste, you would enthuse. You'd get really enthusiastic about things as well and recommend bands and, you know.
Yeah, just bounce ideas and just flashes off each other,
Yeah, just as chat, really, not as people playing together. Uh-huh. But then I went down the next day, and Frank showed me the chords to a couple of songs, and I played the gig, and I think I was in the covers band for a wee while, and then one night somebody said, do you fancy, if you get anything to write, let's try and write arrange stuff. And I said I had a few little cheat chord changes. And it sort of sprang from there. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but that was the kind of roots of the beginning of it. It was all a bit of a, just for fun, really, for kids.
You find a lot of people start off like that, don't they? They just, personalities just bond with each other, and they've got that love for music, so it becomes, you know, becomes a whole thing.
Yeah, there was a bit of kind of there was a few people went through a few changes in sort of personnel before it gelled into the thing where I think when Paul came along, it suddenly gelled into this thing where that was when we first started writing, you know, showing each other ideas and seeing what happened. And there was an afternoon where Frank and myself and Paul, and I think Paul Ford might have been in as well, where things just sort of gelled as a unit.
Right.
We knew we'd got something that was that we liked, you know. Then we just, everything from then on was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's kind of what we did. We were passionate about it.
So were you just out then gigging locally as the Trash Cans? And
really gigging a lot. We'd mostly just write and rehearse and try and work up songs and arrange ideas. Noon again, it'd be a gig. I remember once we got a gig out in, I think it was New Cumnock or something.
Right.
Somehow this guy had phoned Frank, says, I hear you're a band, you want to come and play. And he went and set up, and we did the sound check, and the guy comes through and paid us to get to go. It wasn't quite the thing he wanted.
Cake, 1990. So how did Go Discs pick you up? Because that would be your first label, was it?
Well, there was a bit of, we would record demos. Frank at that point was or at some point within those early days, he got a job in a studio in Kilmarnock called Sirocco at the time.
Yeah.
And he did an engineering course. I think he went down to London. I think the guys in Kilmarnock paid for him to go down to a course in London in engineering, making things and all that. And then because he got in there, so we would go now and again, we would go in there and make little demos. Frank would, you know, use us as kind of, you know, trying out his the things he'd learned on the course. Mm. It was probably late at night, you know, probably did it for free. And I think it was that kind of thing, you know, we'd just go over and whenever we did a song together, we'd demo something up. And eventually we got something that we liked. And I think there was a period where we were sending cassettes out to labels. And there was some sort of thing where Paul and Frank ended up having a day where they would go down to London and go and meet a few people at labels.
Right.
And one of them was a guy at Gold Discs who sort of liked us as people. I think they didn't think we had the material, but they sort of got on really well with Frank and Paul. And he said, listen, I'll get you a couple of gigs. I think this is how it went.
Right. I know, I'm kind of getting you to go back quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of peripheral to these things. I was just hearing the news of the boys going to London and stuff. Aye. But they got Simon, he knew somebody that was involved. I think Simon, who was the guy that they met at Godis, was called Simon. Uh-huh. He was an A&R guy. And he said, listen, I'll get you a couple of gigs with the Lilac Time. They're doing a tour and they're doing two or three gigs in Scotland. So we were like buzzing, and I think there was one in Edinburgh and one in Dundee. And he saw us playing live, and that's when he sort of went back to London and says, we need to sign these guys.
Right.
There was a period where we were kind of working up more material. And I think the song, once we got the first, once we had Obscurity Knocks, we did a demo of that, and that was the one that said, okay. It's served as well, and I think generally the first single you put out into the world gets the most ears, mm-hmm. To it, so a lot of people know that song, and it served as well, and it's one of the ones we still, whenever we do gigs, we probably still fling it in.
Aye.
It was certainly the one that made the other people in the Hookah Company go, okay, this is something they could see working, and back then, whenever it was, 89, 88, I can't remember that one.
So this will be the cake album you'll be working on at this point, is it? Is this the birth of Cake? We always was it always in your mindset that you wanted to record where you stayed? Because you had the recording studio, Shabby Road, that came about around about then?
Yeah, that came about around about then. When we first, there was a period where that we were doing demos, and then when Godis became seriously interested in us, somewhere within us knew that the studio would be important for us. And the guy who ran the studio at the time was thinking of selling it. I think he was wanting to move to Edinburgh and start up another thing.
Right.
So we spoke to Goldust and said, listen, you know, this is what we want to do with the advance. We want to take over this place. It wasn't just a recording studio at the time. It was a bunch of rehearsal rooms.
All right.
9 or 10. And back then, it was quite a good sort of music scene in Kilmarnock where this place was. So the rehearsal rooms were kind of buzzing. There was lots of bands in and out. So the place was kind of in a financially good shape.
Got it.
So we could sort of take it over, and other bands would come in and record. But it became a place where we could go and just, because when we first got signed, we didn't have loads of songs. We had good songs, but we didn't have a load of them. Uh-huh. There was a good period, I think it was maybe a good 2 years before we put something out from signing the deal.
Yeah.
And the studio was the place that we bought, and we just went there and, you know, just the same as previously, it was just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we'd work on our songs.
And that became Cake. So
that became Cake, aye.
Aye. And what an album Cake is, you know, it's one of the albums that stand out. You know, it doesn't matter when you hear it, it's one of the timeless albums, you know, and Obscurity Knocks is a classic, and you know, you've got Only Tongue Can Tell as well on that, you know, they're just classic songs. And you know, when you released that, you broke into America pretty big, you know. It was in the 3 months in the Billboard Top 200 and stuff. That must, for you as a young guy, Fairvin, that must have been mind-blowing.
Absolutely, aye. I can remember the day when we got a phone call in the studio saying, you need to go to America, they're playing your songs on the radio.
I can't hazard.
we were kind of like, at that point, I think the album had been out in Britain, and we were just doing wee shitey gigs.
Uh-huh.
But I mean shitey, I mean we're supporting, like a lot of times you do like a half hour set somewhere and it'd be a nightmare. You wouldn't get a sound check, people would be indifferent. Yeah. You do your own shows and the sound would be a murder, and we were kind of learning a trade, but it was very sporadic. There was no big period of touring.
Uh-huh.
We would just do the odd gig here and there, and we were a bit ramshackle, to be honest.
Right.
A lot of nervous energy and quite a good spirit. But it was nervy, very nervy.
I've Seen Everything, 1993.
So when this phone call came in and said, you need to go to America, we were like, we're just getting it together here. We just started writing a bunch of songs for the next record. And we were beginning to demo them, and we were getting a kind of good feeling. So we thought, stupid now. It sounds daft now, but it didn't really sink in what was going on.
Yeah.
But it turned out great. We went and did a few shows, and I think just before Christmas, I think we did a couple of shows. And then next thing we knew, we were in the tour bus, and we were touring the whole country. Yeah. And we got to, just for the first time, we got to actually do, you know, learn a trade, to play every night for the best part of a month.
Uh-huh.
Got to know about gear, got to know how to work out your sound, you know, got to know a little bit about what it's like being playing to an audience that are enjoying you, which was odd because, you know, the wee gigs around about town, around about Scotland or whatever, you felt as though you're playing to people that were kind of a little bit, there'd be pockets of people who would love it and other people were indifferent.
Yep.
But to go somewhere completely alien, and to have everybody that's in the club has paid good money to see you playing those songs, and you know they were on your side straight away. It took a bit of getting used to, but it was a real big learning period.
Aye.
All that stuff.
Aye, what an experience. What age were you roughly then? Were you early 20s or something?
I was the kind of old fella, so I'd have been, fuck, what have you? I don't know what age I was. That'd be like,
so it's early 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be like, probably about 91. So I was born.
You're now counting on your fingers, John.
I'm trying to figure it out. I was born 63, so 7. I'd have been 28, something like that. 27, 28.
Aye, 27, 28, aye.
About that. And the other boys would probably be, you know, 21.
Aye, 20. Aye. You were just making sure they were okay. Taking them under your wing.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, I was just as daft as they were.
Small doses. Only
said you were already working on the next album, which was I've Seen Everything. So did that just made you focus even more on the American market, or just focus on producing great music?
Not really. I mean, you never really... All we did was focus on writing songs and arranging them so that we could play them and make sure that they were all, you know, something that we thought was good. You know, there was a lot of stuff just through the process that you realise what you don't like doing. And you know, anything out with that was all like a, you know, a kind of crazy accident that you just sort of try and get through and make sure you all stayed reasonably sane with each other. You know, there was no sort of, you know, we didn't have management at the time, or not in management that was in any way sort of listened to, you know. We just were interested in songs, and we were kind of sure enough of what we were doing that if it took us a while, it took us a while, you know, and if we needed to, you know, just, you know, go and try things out and then try them again, and that's what we had to do. You just felt like a kind of real inner strength mixed with a real kind of not knowing what the hell you're doing as soon as you get beyond the fact of getting songs together. But we did learn, doing the second record, we did learn a lot of good things because we'd been on the road at that point.
Yep.
And we'd learned how to play, and we'd learned a little bit about, like, I mean, electric guitars were a bit of a mystery to me. It was all kind of acoustic before then that I'd played.
Mm-hmm.
So you were kind of discovering what guitars you liked playing, what guitars you didn't work. Amplifiers, basic nuts and bolts stuff started to become...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we got started to sink in. And also, the other thing was you kind of learned that a lot of the stuff in the first record didn't really... When you're playing them live, they were such, you know, didn't really lend themselves to that thing. Mm. I don't know why. I still can't put my finger on it quite why. But the second record, we knew that we'd be going out to play these at some point. So that knowledge was behind the kind of writing and arrangements of them.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit less complication going on. A bit more. There was still the odd sort of sophisticated kind of things, but things got a bit more subtle, and things got a bit more kind of, we concentrate on groove a wee bit more, feel. That was the shift, I'd say, between those two records, was the fact that we toured and we learned what was a bit of a pain to play live.
Yep.
And by pain, I mean, you're too focused on the technicality of what you're doing to actually enjoy the fucking thing.
Aye.
Excuse me.
Aye.
I don't mean, so.
No, you're okay.
So,
because songs, they'll take on their own entity anyway when you play them live. Don't they?
Yeah.
They become something, could be totally the opposite from what you've the intention to do in the record. So, you know, they become a living thing once you play it live. And as you say, you know, you on your second album, you maybe kind of concentrate on what we could play live as you know, enjoy the experience as well. If you don't want to be concentrating on everything, you know, chord progressions or notes or whatever, as you say, it's getting that new record and getting it live to the people that want to hear it.
I mean, that's again, our whole mindset was quite, you know, basic as far as that. It's all about writing songs and all about doing things that were just kind of, we knew we were a little bit idiosyncratic. You know, we weren't writing to any sort of blueprint.
Right.
You know, there was definitely a thing within us where we knew that we liked things that were a little bit odd or a little bit, you know, just had a little bit of individuality. So the fact that we got played on the radio was a shock in that sense as well, because we didn't, I mean, even though we write melodic songs and stuff, we kind of knew it wasn't like, you know, regular chat material. It was a little bit, you know, a bit, I don't know what the word is, but not quite, I don't know. It was definitely our own little thing.
But then that creates a cult following that's, you know, it stayed with you all these years, and a huge following. Not if cult's the right word, but you know what I mean? It's a huge following. It's just that you don't want to be mainstream and stuck in, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know about that. I just know that for some reason, people, I mean, we put a lot of love into the songs and a lot of thought and a lot of sort of bloody mindedness about trying to make them the way you exactly want them. And for some reason, you know, there's that connect. A lot of it's to do with, I mean, the main thing is to have some sort of emotional impact. You know, if you get a song that does something to you, that you know that you're ticking all the boxes right. I've seen everything. The fact that people are still to this day sort of listening out for us and still play the old records is, you know, that's a godsend, but you've not really got a lot of say in that. It's just one of those happy, brilliant things that happened.
A Happy Pocket, 1996.
It's all a blur.
I know. I'm sorry for me, John. I've got it all written down here. You're right. The governor for COVID, and I'm this is like 1,001 questions. If it's all a blur,
I'm quite sure. I don't know. That record didn't come out in America. There was a bit of a change in the record company politics. The Gold Discs label was bought by Universal. And then the label in America that put out the first couple of records changed to another label, and they weren't interested in us. Also, the radio had sort of shifted in America. The Nirvana and the sort of grunge stuff became the staple diet. Of the radios that were maybe a year previously, they'd have been a bit more friendly to our kind of thing. Uh-huh. Things sort of shifted in quite a few ways. But that's just looking back. At the time, we didn't, didn't really think of those things. I'm sure we probably did tour America around about that time. I don't know. Or maybe did a couple of shows. God knows.
He's done so much into all these albums, and although you're at the coalface as such, but guys like myself who, you know, we all love the Trash Can Snatch, there's such a selection of music to choose from, you know, producing an album, come out with an album in 90, come out with an album in 93, another album in 96. We'll be right back. Weightlifting, 2004.
There was a sort of good gap. I think it was about, I don't know how many years, 6 years or something.
Right.
We had a few issues with the record company. We left the record company. And the deals all came to an end. And we just, we kind of drifted for a while. The studio, the tax man came and took the studio.
Ah.
Yeah. You know, our kind of financial affairs, I suppose, weren't the best handled over those years. I think it's a bit of a common story in a lot of bands back in those days. So we ended up having to just drift for a while, and we would still write songs and you know, sending cassettes to each other and working away in our little four tracks. And I think there was still a little thing. The Japanese label would bring us across. We'd do some shows over there. So there was sort of sporadic periods of kind of activity.
Right.
And the most thing was just working away in songs. And there was a time we tried to go and record a fourth record,
mm-hmm.
but it was too dark, the kind of music and the mood that we came away with the recordings. And we just felt it was too, because there'd been a big long gap for the previous record, we didn't want to come back with something that was dark. And we left it another while and wrote some more songs. And then eventually we felt as though we had a nice bunch of things that would gel together.
Aye.
And then we got some funding, I think, for Scottish Arts Council.
Mm.
Went down to Busby and worked in with, I can't remember the name of the studio. It was terrible. Johnny and Duncan Cameron's place in Busby. And we recorded in there.
Right.
Just kind of go down in the mornings, do a bunch of recording, head off about tea time, you know, kind of Monday to Friday.
Uh-huh.
Regular. There was a couple of late nights.
To kind of get back into that zone again, maybe just say with the way things had panned out over that gap in the years, just to kind of get that creativity flowing again. As you say, you've been putting four tracks together and sending it on to each other. It's a kind of,
yeah, well, the studio we kind of pretty much had everything figured out before we went in.
Mm.
You know, we'd been rehearsing, and you know, we knew what we were doing as far as what we, you know, the songs. We weren't going in and sort of trying to arrange things or,
aye,
you know, jamming as such. We kind of knew what we were doing, and then we sent it off to a guy in the States, in New York. We sent one song to him, and he came back. The thing he sent back, we really liked, so we sent him the whole bunch of stuff. And the record was, it just felt great. It felt like how it was, the name, everything. It just felt, it felt exactly how we felt. There was a weight lifted.
Uh-huh.
We felt all right with each other. We felt as though we were back in our groove again. We had a bunch of stuff that we were chuffed with, and we did lots of different moods were in the record.
Yep.
Good bit of variety, a good bit of kind of depth to the lyrics.
Right.
Very reflective of our journey at times, and our individual journeys as well.
Uh-huh.
And just a record we're really proud of, and it went down well. People loved it everywhere, and we toured. Aye.
Discover the wheel and watch the buildings go by. You talk a little soft, turn off the radio. I just wanna hear all the past times, the rushed hours, the endless lies.
I mean, the weightlifting, the song is beautiful. You know, it's again, it's one of your classic songs. It was very, very touching. It's very, you know, it hits straight to the heart. And there's footage when you play the winery in New York. So it's just a stripped back, acoustic version of it. And
yeah,
it's beautiful. You know, it's such a lovely song.
Well, you don't get them every day, but there's ones where you know there's a power within them, where things, you know, a phrase will gel with a chord change and a voice, and it all just works and it does its thing. And that one was, you know, it's a very special song. It arrived at a good time for us, and it took a while to finish, but we knew straight away that it was powerful, and it kind of spoke to all of it, to us at the feeling that we were in at the time. It just said the right stuff. A lot of these things are just talking to yourself when you're writing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if so you can try.
How does the songwriting process for the Trash Can Sonatas, how does that come about? Is it all of you chipping a bit, or?
It's all very varied. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's five of us, and we'll all, you know, it goes from somebody walking in with a fully formed, strong thing that starts and finishes, and we all jump on board and think, right, that's great, doesn't need a thing, fantastic, well done, to somebody come up with a chord change and it hangs about for 10 years, and then somebody will grab it and go, I've got a thing for this, or somebody will have a verse, or somebody will think they've got a fully fledged thing, and somebody will go, "That's great, but that's pish." That's this. And that could be bruising at times, but also that's where your trust comes in, and you know, we're all, you know, whatever happens, there's a kind of thing where eventually it all pans out.
On the sunset, horses
That's why we're, you know, still doing it to this day. I think there's a healthy sort of respect, yep, with also a healthy sort of disdain.
You know, who were your influences then? Did you
everything?
Aye,
I am like as all, you know. From the day I discovered and loved the music, you just devour everything, every single fucking thing. And you know, but I think the first things I remember are things like The Sweet. Right. And Shawardy Wardy and Brotherhood of Man. And, you know, that's the first, you know, just a wee boy watching the telly on a Thursday night, which is pretty much the only place where music was a thing.
Yep.
Get it in the morning radio, but the main thing was that Thursday night, once a week for half an hour, you'd see these space people doing this amazing thing.
Top of the pops there.
You'd never think you'd come close to. And then you get to your sort of teenage years, and even before, but when first could afford to buy records, like the whole world sort of arrives. And we're of that era where it was before the internet, so you had to go and search things out. Uh-huh. Sometimes you couldn't even find them. You know, there'd be artists that you love, and there'd be records that you would just, they'd be in your imagination. How's that going to sound? Where is it? I kind of get it.
Aye.
And then you just sort of devour everything.
Mm-hmm.
Country, dance, music, you know, disco stuff, jazz, folk, rock, you know, the lot, the gamut, reggae, everything.
Aye.
That's been like, you know, like anybody, you know, it's a great thing was John Peel growing up.
Aye.
Yeah, Jensen, all those kind of characters. Opened your ears to a lot of stuff that was, you'd play five records in a row and each one of them would be like from a different, totally different place, you know.
Uh-huh.
There was a, you know, everything's an impact.
I mean, you went from, for the weightlifting, which seems to be it's a big personal journey for yous all, you know, bringing that album out. And you extensively went on tour with that, you know, we went to America, Canada, Britain, Japan, Ireland, so we're back in the swing of it again, and then two or three years later, we've got another album again. You know, were these songs, did you have a backlog of, or did you have a whole catalogue of songs from weightlifting to in the music? Was there a big slit, or did you just, was it a constant progression? You just keep working on new material all the time?
Just keep working.
Aye.
You're right, you know, we toured a lot with weightlifting, so we're just playing a lot. We got a little place to rehearse in Glasgow, behind the Bayhorse Tavern, Queen's Park.
Right.
And it was like a lock-in place. You know, I could go there at 2 a.m. if I had an idea and turn the guitar amp up and not make a racket.
Right.
There was new neighbours, you know, it was just our wee place.
Aye.
So we'd rehearse there for gigs and also just working up material. We would jam quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
Any songs that were kind of becoming... like we'd still be sending our four-track stuff around in our cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd start to rehearse, but we'd have a mind to keep things a bit loose. I think I don't know why, but for some reason we thought the next record we do, we want it to be a bit more, we just go in and play live and we get a good take and that's it.
Yep.
Weightlifting was, we'd build things up on weightlifting, even though we had all the arrangements ready. You'd get the drums down and get the bass sorted and then do the guitars, and it took a wee bit, it was a bit of a putting things into place that way, and we decided we wanted to try a more live thing.
In the Music, 2007.
Yeah, all those songs are written and but not rehearsed up to a crazy amount.
Right.
Kept it a bit loose, and then we went to New York and with the guy that had mixed weightlifting, he had a studio in New York, so I said we'll come over and we'll do a record from the start, because he so loved working on weightlifting, but he wanted to work with us from scratch. And he was a bit dubious about the notion of us playing live.
Was that Andy Chase?
Andy Chase, aye.
Andy, aye.
We got through, I think we got to know him initially through our Japanese label. They recommended him.
Right.
He did production for a few things. Tahiti 80, I don't know if you remember the name.
Oh, aye, yep, aye.
Sonically, he knew what he was doing, and he had this great place in Manhattan. So we went over there and set up to play live. And of course, as soon as we played the first song, he said, "Great, this is fine." I said, "You're exactly right. That's what we're going to do."
Naked to your love, I cry.
So everything was just get a good take, that's it, great. Maybe overdub a few harmonies, but mostly it was just us playing live, and the songs hadn't been over-rehearsed, so there was a bit of looseness about what we were playing.
And yeah, is it true that Carly Simon does the backing vocals on one of the songs on that album?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it backing vocals, it's more like a
right
sort of duet thing. Yeah, he was one of the things, we did the recording in New York, and then we had to go and do the mixing in Martha's Vineyard. Uh-huh. It's a kind of island north of New York. And that's where Carly lives. It's quite a small island, like the size of Arran, maybe.
Right.
So they all know each other.
Aye.
And Andy's family. Andy Chase, the guy that did the production, his family had a place up there. So he wanted us to go up there. I think we did the vocals. We did some vocals up there as well as mixing.
Right.
While we were there, he said, blah, blah, Carly's lives up the road. And I kind of, there's a couple of records of hers I really love. There's an album called No Secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of songs on it that are great. So I wrote her a thing. I don't know if that made much difference. I wrote her a letter and we sent her a cassette or whatever it was, CD with a couple of songs. And Andy was like, she's never going to do this. You know, she gets asked every time to do stuff. But for some reason, she really connected with the song, with one of the songs. And next thing you know, we weren't there, we'd split, and then he got her in to do this thing, and aye, lovely. You couldn't sort of make it up.
Is it safe? There's a life, there's a love, there's an all my friends. There's a life, there's a love, there's an all my friends. There's a life, there's a love, there's an all my friends. There's a life, there's a love, there's an all my
guys for everything.
Well, just, you know, it's like, you know, a total legend kind of thing. And she sings beautifully on it, you know, it's gorgeous, gorgeous singer. So it's a treat to have that on your record.
I mean, in the music, that another great album that you've brought, you know, all your albums are great, and in the music's another great one. You know, there's a maturity going from the weightlifting and then into the music. And then do you decide to do a acoustic album? Is that Brill?
I don't know if you decide to do that.
Right.
It's more you're just doing gigs and then somebody plays you. And goes, hey, this is pretty good. And you go, okay, well, we did one in America as well, the one called Fez.
Right.
But I don't know how we started doing that, but I think one of the things we got about Scunnardly was the amount of palaver it is to do a big band gig. We were a six-piece band for all through the weightlifting tour and the indie music. And that's a lot of people and a lot of gear.
Aye.
To take around the world and to handle. Aye. just because it's quite intense when you're touring everywhere. You know, you're all the way across America, across Australia and Japan. You know, with a sort of relatively, like a pal from Kilmarnock playing the bass. Grant is brilliant. I mean, Stevie on the keyboards was great. But, you know, it takes its toll having that amount of time together. So I think also, I mean, the big thing is the financing of that as well. It's quite we never really made any sort of money. Everybody got paid, it needed to get paid. But for us as the band, it was, we just wanted to do the record justice and go and play it everywhere, play it the way it was made. And we got, I think we were all by the end of all that. And then same way in the music, it was the same. I think we had a different bass player on the road in the music. Aye, Frank Devana, we had an American guy come play bass with us.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we were all over the place, everywhere. So we were exhausted by all that. And then somebody mentioned, do you fancy doing some acoustic shows? Just the stripped down band.
Yep.
And we did, I think, I don't know why, but the first ones might have been in America. And it was great. You got to play very different venues, you know, little plush clubs where people have their dinner and, you know, and then the show comes on and, you know, you're the second show of the night and you're backstage and there's, you know, the sort of glamour girls all getting dolled up for the next show.
Aye.
You're in this kind of crazy showbiz sort of world, which was fun, a lot of fun to do. Plus, the other thing is you're not having to set up all the gear and strip down the gear. It's just you and your guitar.
Aye.
So you can get there later and you can leave earlier and, Also you can make a few quid because, you know, there's not as many wages going out the door.
Aye, your overheads are slightly less, eh? And it's yeah. just still about the music. So a lot of the time the stripped back acoustic stuff is, you know, yeah. it's more personal anyway, isn't it? It feels more.
And it is where a lot of the songs first come around. Uh-huh. All through the career, all through your records, there's a bunch of songs on there that began on acoustic guitar. So to play them that way, a lot of them, it's not unfamiliar. You know, it's just Aye. the way they started, you know. Yep. So it was a treat to do that. And then somebody played us the recordings from Braille. We did a few nights in Braille. Our manager, Robin, at the time, I think he was a part owner of Braille. It used to be a really great gig, actually. There was, like, American bands would come through and play there, and it was kind of on the circuit. It's a uh-huh. small and intimate sort of place, but they would get loads of people going through it.
Yep.
And we played, I think, 4 weekends in a row, just sort of house band, and do different sets every night, and just very relaxed and
Aye.
Chilled out, made a few bob, made some nice music. And then, as you say, you know, somebody put it out, the recording was good, and we just began to enjoy the sound of that, you know, mm-hmm. just nice. You know, you could focus in on the singing and a lot more, and just relaxed, very relaxed. It was good fun. We probably did it. I don't think any of us would relish doing it again. We did it for a while in the States, just touring like that, 2 or 3 years in a row we did it. Uh-huh. Eventually, you sort of go, right, enough of that.
Aye.
let's get the drums and all that. Let's get the boys back.
Get the boys back in. And then we go from that and we go to your kind of last album, your sixth album, Wild Pendulum.
Oh, aye, aye.
That's the last we've heard from you. You know, it's...
Well, there's been a couple of singles since then.
Aye, we've had a couple of singles, aye. Wild Pendulum, we had Best Days of Earth. Best Days on Earth is lovely.
Out of the darkness came the light, turning the stars in diary pages. I'll stare at the day our stars align, and I'll fold it away for the ages. Delicate orgasmic time. We can unfold it when we get older. It's one of my best days on earth. 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 One of my best days on earth.
You know, that's a beautiful song.
Yeah. That's one of my favourites as well. Again, it's somebody like Paul come up with that line and that chorus, and you knew straight away, like, that's, you know, that's us. That, there you go. That's one of our straight away.
Aye.
Says something really, really human, but says it in a slightly odd sort of way. And Paul's great with chord changes. This, you know, you think it's going to do this and it does that. And, oh, okay. That really worked. Yeah, so cracker. I love that song.
So what, I know I'm conscious of our time and stuff, and I know I appreciate that you're not feeling 100% and you're just listening to me ramble on. So I do appreciate that. So after Wild Pendulum, you say with a couple of live singles and things, is this when your Patreon page came? Did this start around about then?
I think so. I had a couple of years of internal debate about whether to get involved in Patreon, and then came a time where it was like, no, it's kind of perfect for our thing. And also it's sort of the way the world is and the way the music sort of businesses went, it seemed to be the only way where acts who aren't, you know, on huge labels, that's the only way to get around and to make records to the standards that you want to make them, and and acknowledge that there is people that are now, what's the word, acclimatized. Your fans, your regular Joe that buys records, is very much acclimatized to the Patreon way of doing things. I think it was used to be Kickstarter and various things, but Patreon seems to be the one that suits the musicians very well. And it seems to be, as I say, you know, the punters get it.
Yep, aye.
So, and you know, it's been interesting to sort of provide that type. The way we sold it to ourselves, which we had to do, I mean, we've seen a lot of people doing it quite badly. And we thought, what we should do is treat this like an old-fashioned fan club. It's for the geeks. It's not for regular Joe. It's for people who really want to know the B-side and know where it came from and hear the demo of the B-side. And hear, you know, that is for that kind of thing. So we've got plenty of archive stuff that's chunky. And we can be a bit more open about, you know, if we want to blather on about something, or, you know, just recommend tunes. Rather than... Previous to that, we thought it was this thing where you had to actually pre-sell your records.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you had to pre-sell shows, and you had to promise people you're going to show up in their back garden, and, you know, all this stuff. And it was like, that's just hellish. That sounds hellish.
Aye.
As soon as we ruled out any of that and just says, no, we're going to use our archive and we'll use our own personalities and treat it like an old-fashioned fan club. It's just weird for the geeks and for the, you know, I'm a geek myself. I'm quite proud of it. I'm the same as artists that I want to, you know about the B side and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So
I think we've all got that in us, haven't we? We've all got that. We want to, if we like a band is like that, we want to find out everything about and how that concept of that song came about. And it seems it's really, really popular. You know, your Patreon page.
You know, it's good. You know, it's funded the nature of the way we are just now. There's two of the guys, Frank and Paul, live in the States on the West Coast. Paul lives up near Portland. Frank's in Pasadena.
Right.
And us three are over here, Stephen and myself live in Glasgow, and Davey lives in Kilmarnock. And so to get us together is quite a, you know, it takes a few bob.
We've
figured out a way of where three of myself and Stephen and Davey, we can rehearse here. So it's the drums and the bass and the guitar, and we can work up that side of things and go into a studio and record that, and the boys can chip in there.
Yeah.
They'll listen, we'll rehearse maybe once a week, and we'll send records of the rehearsals, and the boys will come back and say, that's good, but that, could you do that? Or that beat's working, or that arrangement's working. Kind of in a, it's pretty healthy actually, pretty healthy way to do things, especially with COVID, it worked really great.
Aye.
We weren't rehearsing as much, but when we did start rehearsing, it was, you know, it turned out great. You know, we could, so we went through that process with a single out during COVID, the closer you move away from me.
Thank you.
and we did a video and stuff during COVID. And then there was another one called Ways, which I recorded the same way.
What's the first thing that comes into your head? Aren't you afraid of eternal hell? One of my favorite things in the world, and it would take me away from myself. Ways to change the pain to something else. I can't.
That's a kind of ongoing process now. We'll, every now and again, we'll use some of the Patreon funds to go into the studio and record. Frank was over for a wee bit this summer, so he was actually, there was four of us in the studio for a little while.
Right, right.
But we've kind of, we're okay with this kind of thing where we don't have to rustle up $2,000 worth of airfare.
Aye, aye.
And gigs and living money for everybody to go and record. We can do it relatively cheaply and economically. Aye. And we still get the kind of stuff that, you know, it's to a standard that we think sits well in the catalogue.
Aye.
So it's kind of cool.
Do you miss, well, you're going to miss going out on tour, don't you? Do you miss touring?
Yeah, well, I mean, the touring's been a funny one. Over the years, when I look back on it, there's never been a whole kind of, right, we're all into touring.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of the guys that never really enjoyed gigging. Don't mind the after party.
You're not going to say the names, though, eh?
Well, you know, that would spoil. You know, I might be the guy, that might be mm-hmm. me. You know, and that's that. Obviously, there's, you know, there's come and go. There'll be times when it's brilliant, times when it's great. But as a rule, you know, it'd be like, you know, I'd rather just do the after party. Whereas there's other ones that I'd rather just do the gig and. Of an age now where the after party probably isn't appealing to any of us, actually, to be truthful.
It's an after tea.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit of grub.
A bit of grub.
Gigging is the great thing about gigging is, you know, it's there. You get to see the physical thing that you do. It's not just somebody writing you an email. You actually see it there in the room, people singing along, people lost in the music.
Yep.
And yourself, you're lost in the music and find new things in the music. And also I miss the company. We all miss each other's company, you know. And touring's a great thing for that because you know, you're not just there for the night. You're there for a couple of weeks or whatever, and you get to know each other again and see where you're at these days.
Aye,
yeah. It's difficult to sort of envisage it right now. Because of various things, COVID is a big one. Travel's kind of getting a bit back on the map, but I mean, I'm just getting over a big bout of it, and
aye.
I know that doesn't mean I won't get it again. I've got pals who've had it two or three times. And there's the long COVID is the thing that kind of scares me. I'm hoping there's none of that going on.
Aye. But
the major thing going on just now is we're just trying to finish an album. So it's never in your mind doing gigs when you're doing that. All you're thinking about is getting the songs right and getting enough of them. And then
that's some of the questions that I have for you. So R Mac from the Twitter says, what is your favourite Trash Can Sinatra song?
Well, it's always the stuff you're working on is the stuff that floats your boat. I mean, if I was to think about stuff in the past, I'd probably say something like Oranges and Apples. I like that.
Oranges and Apples, right, okay. I'm going to try and go quick fire because we're on the countdown. The second question was, did you ever have a drummer called Peter Dunlop?
Oh, we did. Aye, right. That's way back in the day. In fact, Peter Dunlop might have been there when we did the sound check and the guy paid us to go away.
Right.
That guy. Peter was a great drummer. He was one of the guys that you'd hear in the rehearsal rooms. And we were, before Steven joined the band, we were kind of a bit stuck for drummers.
Uh-huh.
We got asked to do a gig. I think there was another guy called Fergus that he was a great drummer. Again, a great drummer, still kicking around, still playing. But, you know, it just wasn't, the chemistry didn't gel. And that's just one of these things you can't really debate, you know.
Right.
We kind of learned that early on. As I said, there was a few people went through the band, but there's a chemistry where you know that for some reason, in the back of your head, you know, right, if I'm with this person for 20 years, it's going to be all right.
Aye.
Yeah. And we're solidly going to do this. Not that you'd think of these things, but you know that somebody's on the same page as you, mm-hmm. as far as writing music goes. And it's, so chemistry is a big thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Peter.
Aye. So we have the same question from Matt Richards and Guy Foster. Both of them ask, is there any UK dates planned?
Well, I hinted at that earlier. No, there's no dates planned. I wish there was. There's plenty of people would be in. I get offers all the time.
Aye.
But financially, it's very difficult to get anybody in the country for any length of time, and the money that costs. You know, I'm sure we could do, you know, if we were bringing out a record, say, you know, later this year or next year, and I'm sure that there'd be something that we try and organise. I don't know what it would entail, but I'm sure there'd be something. But right now, it's no one, we're just thinking of making the record.
Yeah. Well, that follows on to Matt's next question, which is, when's the new album out and what's it called?
There's no called anything yet.
Right.
There has been suggestions for names, but nothing stuck.
Okay.
In an ideal world, realistically, I would say next year.
Right. Okay.
It's in an ideal world. We're chugging away and doing what we always do, and we're all focused on it. But sometimes it takes a wee bit of time.
Yep. Aye. And Matt's final question is, what are you listening to now?
What am I listening to now? Oh my God. That's tough. Listening to things is weird.
Aye.
When you're writing songs, it can really not be healthy to listen to stuff. So I tend to find myself listening to things that are so not on the radar of affecting what I'm doing.
Right.
What was I listening to last night? I don't know. Things will grab you. I was watching a program. It's kind of shitey. Television program about the Midwich Cuckoos, which is a great story, actually. John Wyndham,
right?
There's a BBC TV adaptation, and at the very end of one of the programs, this sort of choral piece came on, like choir boys singing, really beautiful. Right. I wish I could remember what it was called. I don't know, it was episode 3 or something, right at the very end. And I went into Spotify, I got the name of it, and I went into Spotify and I was listening to that. That was really beautiful,
right.
So I can listen to things like that, but and the danger is listening to things like Dylan or something, where you'll just feel, oh no, there's no point doing anything.
Oh, well, I suppose then that's
listening to things is difficult.
Aye. So Simon H, I've got another question for you, John. I'm just bombarding you with questions. Simon H has asked me, busking in London, was it enjoyable, and did you play any of your own songs?
Oh. But yes, very enjoyable. I used to busk. This was in a period where we were kind of down on our luck. And I think it was after Happy Pocket, in between Happy Pocket and Weightlifting, there was a period where I would be down in London with my girlfriend at the time and traveling back up to Kilmarnock to work on songs and then going back to being my girlfriend. And while I was down there, she would be out at work and I would go, I'd get my guitar and I'd go into like Hyde Park Corner, Marble Arch area, where there's lovely little underpasses that go to the tube station.
Yep.
But there's underpasses where there's sections of it. There's not the tube station crowd, it's just the little corridors that go to the park. So there's a great reverb.
Uh-huh.
And I would play there, and so it was enjoyable to sing because it was great reverb. And yeah, I would sing the odd song of ours.
Good.
There's a song we got called Leave Me Alone that used to, people would stop and go, oh. Catch the ear, but mostly it was other people's songs. But yeah, it was great, great fun. Highly recommend it. You meet a good class of people as well. Some great buskers, great fun.
Super. So that's all my questions, but I've got a couple of questions for you. We have 4 minutes left on the clock, right? So if you could sum up your life in the Trash Can Sinatras in 3 words, what would the three words be?
Three words? Interesting. Uh-huh. Rich. Not rich in finance, but rich as in, you know,
humanity.
Chunky. Just chunky, lots of stuff. Exciting.
Right. Interesting, rich, and exciting. We're gone with that. That's super. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you your favourite trash can song. It's just because...
Oh, change all the time.
Change all the time. Yep. Where's the best place for us to buy your music?
Let me think. I don't really know how that stuff goes, but probably from our website.
Right.
But anybody can buy it. The label that we're on just now, or this, there's been reissues from LNFG Records in Glasgow.
Aye.
They're great for two things. Great because the packaging and the remix and the remastering and all that is done to a really high standard. And also, we actually receive good earnings from those vinyl sales, good. which is pretty rare.
I could be wrong. Is it Paul McGeechan, our good friend Paul McGeechan, that does most of the remastering?
He's done the remastering for our two older records, yeah. Aye.
So LNFG is where we should buy your records from.
Well, yeah, if you want a vinyl, aye.
If you want vinyl, aye.
Yeah.
Aye. Right. And my final question to you, John, is do you have a favourite Trash Cans gig out of all the gigs you've played?
You mean venue or just a gig? The gig that I loved when I think back on it is the very first tour we did of America. We started off in the kind of West Coast. We started off over in Los Angeles, I think, anyway.
Uh-huh.
But one of the gigs we did was at CBGB's in New York, which is shut. It's been shut for years now.
Right.
But that's a bit of a classic venue. It's a dump. It's a total toilet. You know. It was brilliant. It was one of the first places where, just to go to a historic venue to play it, and you're looking out to all these people who, you know, you don't know you from Adam, and it's a real multicultural crowd, and they're all, you know, there was a song called Orange Fell, which is on our second record, and I think we might have played it, one of the first times we played it was that night, and it's quite a hypnotic song.
Uh-huh.
I remember looking at the crowd, and I could just see all these people standing with their eyes shut, just sort of lost in this thing that they'd never heard before.
Yep.
So it's a powerful moment, and just a great, you know, we did a version of it, because it's a real punk venue. It's
right.
An old sort of old school New York grotty venue. The Ramones and Television and all these bands came out of it. So we did in tribute to that, we did the Spanish Stroll, the Mike DeVille hit, because I think he was one of the people that used to play in that venue. So that was CBGB.
Great stuff, John. I can't say thank you very much. This has been an absolute pleasure for me.
Cheers. Thank you.
Slightly wee technical issues, but we've overcame it. So we look forward to your new album when this comes out. And hopefully, if the stars align, we'll see you back on the road. But ultimately, get well soon. And thanks very much for your time. You know, I appreciate it.
A pleasure, Diggy. Thanks very much.
No, not a problem. And if I'd maybe touch base with you and see if Eddie wants to come on when she's feeling okay We need to go through the management company and try and get it sorted, see if she wants a chat.
I'll have a word.
Well, everybody, that's the end of the episode. That was fantastic. I really loved chatting with John. What a guy. And John, thanks very much. I know you had COVID and you were just recovering, so I really do appreciate it. It was great. Longer than expected, but you had to cover your whole career, so thank you very much. So what I'm going to do is I'll post the links to the Trash Can Sinatra's Patreon page. You can join it from as little as £5 a month, and you get loads of info behind the scenes. You get demos. It's just fantastic stuff. So go and check that out. I'll also post a link to Last Night from Glasgow if you fancy getting some vinyl from the Trash Cans. There's your man there. So Last Night from Glasgow is a great place to go and get your vinyl. So the music you hear in the background is the song John couldn't remember when we were chatting. So he messaged me the next day, and it is called Benedictus, and it's from the Midwich Cuckoos. notes by Carol Jenkins, composer Carol Jenkins, Voices 8 and Christian Forsham. I'm just going to let it play out a wee bit. Just before I go though, next episode will be with Paul McGeachan, the legendary again, Paul McGeachan, from Friends Again, Love and Money and Starless. And just one final thing is a huge thanks to everybody that listens. If you leave some feedback, just so I know people are listening. Catch up with you in the next one, everybody. Cheers. Thank you. Bye.